Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. And welcome. And the show is pre-recorded, I must say. So here we go. Hello and welcome.
Hello.
To Feed Your Head, we've got Terry Grigg here. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Ruthann.
Now, you are in Northern Scotland.
I am indeed, yes.
You are, yes. You know, we're going to talk about your travels. You've been on all the continents traveling except Antarctica.
That's right.
So you are a world traveler. You're
yep.
a writer. You're an yep. activist for the environment.
Yep. I am, yes.
You're all of these things. And you've written a book called Backpacking with a Bunion.
Yeah, it's a good title, isn't it?
I wanted to ask you, are you not wearing the right socks or shoes, or why would you get a bunion? Tell me.
They're genetic, basically. There's not much you can do about it, but it sort of develops when you get older. So the whole idea was the allusion to the mature traveller, because I started the travelling when I was travelling big time when I was about in my 40s, and I just thought it'd be a comical way to put that in the title.
Yeah. Well, that's funny. It's but because I've always heard people talk about bunions, and it's like, oh my goodness, that sounds horrible. And then you're backpacking. How much?
Yeah.
What kind of weight do you carry usually when you're traveling?
Weight. I haven't really thought about it really. But I travel very lightly.
Okay.
It's basically because all you really need when you go traveling is really your passport, you need your plastic, your credit cards, you need a decent pair of walking boots and a few other bits and pieces and most other things you can buy when you're en route if you lose anything or you need to replace them. So I travel very lightly.
Okay. So you don't take the sleeping bag necessarily, or you wait till you get to the country before you get that kind of thing?
I'm specifically going for trekking or for long distance hiking. Yes, I'll take the sleeping bag. But in the tropics, you don't really need a sleeping bag. You could take a sheet or something, or you can always buy something out there.
Right.
But unless you're trekking at altitude or you're trekking, you know, in a cold country, you don't really need these extra things. But yeah, you can take a small sleeping bag.
Yeah. Well, when they are backpacking with a bunion, this isn't for all your travels. This is basically Southeast Asia, right?
Right, yeah.
So has that been your favorite place so far, or do you not want to mention your favorite and your least favorite?
It's difficult having favorites because Southeast Asia is fantastic for the culture, for the actual variety of scenery, for the different ways of life, and it's very easy traveling. It's you can get around easily. There's not a lot of bureaucratic hurdles getting through into different countries like there are some parts of the world.
Oh,
and,
okay.
It's also relatively compact, so you can spend most of your time going overland. So you haven't got lots of, you don't have to fly everywhere. You'll normally, you know, go overland in these sort of places.
Right.
But if you want the culture and the way of life, that is a great place to be. But if you, for example, wanted something far more adventurous, perhaps, or the wildlife, then parts of Africa will be better. So it really depends on what you're looking for.
Right. Well, I know that you're a vegan, and I have a lot of vegan Facebook group friends and all who are living in Southeast Asia just because of the climate and their access to fresh fruits and things. They love it.
Yeah, it's one of the easier parts of the world to actually be vegan. So, So, and as you say, the climate, tropical fruits, ideal. And you have rice and noodles, so.
Yeah, how could you go wrong? Well, where was your first major trip to, Terry?
First major trip? I went to India. Well, I actually went to the States many, many years ago, but I suppose that wasn't really what I regard as a major trip. It was still the Western world. Right. And I'd when I was in my sort of teens, early 20s, I actually went round Europe. There's a thing called Interrail, which you can actually I used to be able to travel on the railways all the way through Europe. So I did that when I was younger. The first major trip, I suppose, outside the Western world would be when I went for Africa. And I actually did one of these overland trips on one of these trucks, part of the time anyway, from Nairobi all the way down to Cape Town.
Okay, so you saw an awful lot of wildlife there.
Oh, yeah, that is the place. If you want to see the big mammals, that is the place to go, where a lot of them are still, you know, you still get the mass migrations in the Serengeti, for example. And so it's pretty spectacular.
Yeah, it has to be, and that's something that we really have to save. Now, you are an environmentalist, and I guess that just goes along, and being green with everything you've seen, because you've seen such wonderful things, you want to preserve them. Which came first? Your trips, or were you a big environmentalist before?
I think I've always been, you know, had the environmental sort of tag, if you like. I've always thought about the environment and about looking, you know, not spoiling the environment, not ruining the environment, and looking after it, you know, having concern for other species, and not just basically trashing the planet, as what we have been doing over, you know, over many years. So that probably came first, and I suppose just wanting to find out what the world was like, and if other people had different views and attitudes, and to sort of, the two really came along together. But I suppose the environmental thing was what kicked off first.
More, yeah. Okay. Well, you've worked with plants, like in a nursery, garden centers.
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Like that. So you grow things now, right? Your garden.
I wouldn't say I have obviously had a garden, but I wouldn't say I'm into growing things a lot at the moment, because I do spend a lot of time traveling and writing and other things. But yes, it is a secondary interest, I suppose.
Right.
But yeah, I do still garden, but I wouldn't say it's a huge part of my life.
Right. Well, just for the reasons you said, it's hard during gardening season. You need to be around, and unless you have, you know, somebody else to check on it.
I tend to grow things and let them look after themselves, rather than having, you know, constant care and attention.
Right.
And I'd grow plants that can survive because we've had a couple of bad winters and things have died. So it's always best to have plants that suit the environment, rather than plants that you like and you try and force to live in a certain environment. I think that's
exactly
very important.
That's all part of permaculture and all of that. What about the animal sanctuaries you've worked in also?
That was when I was in England, in a place in Devon, which is in southern England, and it was International Animal Rescue, and it's quite a well-known organisation. And this is sort of like the British branch of it, and it was basically looking after animals, domesticated animals that have been rescued. There's sheep and cows and pigs and so forth, and some race horses that were no longer being used in the racing industry, and just basically caring for them. The actual guy, a guy called John Hicks, I think his name was, he's actually now got a sanctuary in India. He's looking after tigers.
Oh, okay.
So that's quite an interest. I haven't contacted him for ages, but yeah, that is what I was doing for quite a while. That's a few years ago now.
Yeah, but then I bet you found, we had on another show last night, Andrew Kirshner from Southern Florida, and he was talking about, he also is a vegan and big with animal rights. He talked about turkeys. And in some of these rescue places, and he said, if you've ever, you know, known a turkey, he said they'll sit on your lap.
Right.
They run over to you. They sit on your lap. They make some purring sound. He said, you know, people don't understand that, you know, these animals, they have all the same emotions and all that we do. And I frequently say,
all sentient, yeah.
Yeah, they are. My dog had cried when his daughter died. And, you know, people think, oh, yeah, right. Well, he did. They have all these feelings. And so taking care of them, I think, is a must, actually.
Well, yeah, there's a saying, isn't there, about it's not whether they think like us or look like us, but whether they can suffer, isn't it, or something like that.
Right, and they do.
They do with factory farming and, as you say, intensive farming and all these battery hens and pig, you know, crates and all the rest of it, you know.
What we as humans have done to our fellow beings on this planet is just phenomenal. I know that one of your interests is population control.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Terry? Because that's...
Sure, yeah, it's something I've concentrated on quite a lot recently, actually. I think certainly with the population, world population now being over 7 billion, and you can go to various sites where you can see the numbers going up every single second, like...
Yeah. Yeah.
While we've been talking in half an hour, you know, the population's gone up another 500,000, for example. And governments seem to be doing very little about it. In fact, they seem to be encouraging population growth rather than trying to limit it.
It's one of those things. I remember when it turned up to the 7 million mark. You probably do, too, on Facebook. And
yeah.
People were, like, they were so excited in a good way. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, hell. You know, we can sort of feed, we could, if we were doing things right, we could feed this many people. But why, you know, why do people just want to keep having more children knowing how the world is right now? It doesn't seem like a very kind thing to do.
Well, it's all to do with quantity and not quality. There was something on Facebook I was actually reading earlier today. It's population growth, a Ponzi scheme, whereby basically more and more people basically means more and more consumers. It also knocks wages down. So, it actually increases power, influence of corporations, of the elite, of governments to have more people. And the more people there are, the less one individual matters. And governments just love crushing the individual.
More numbers, yeah. Well, now this has been said, and I think it's probably right on. In this country, you know, they've been trying to, the far right has been trying to make laws against, against sex education, against abortion, against birth control, on and on. And the thought seems to be that this is a bunch of far-right white people who have read the figures and that they know within so many decades that white people in the United States would be a minority.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Don't want that. And and so they're trying to, get into a woman's body to see that that doesn't happen, which is just, they're thinking ahead in the wrong way. Instead of thinking what kind of impact on our planet will this many people have, they don't seem to care about the planet, obviously.
No, it's very selfish and sort of narcissistic sort of self-interest, really,
to
like dominate and control. And as you say, there are other groups other than the white sort of rich middle class or upper class or whatever, but there's other groups, the Catholics throughout the world, the Muslims, a lot of Muslims, a lot of different religious groups also have the same sort of mentality, as if one group is trying to outbreed another to try and dominate another particular group. And like India and China, they're getting bigger and bigger, and they're trying to become more dominant, presumably by becoming more populous. I don't know the sort of reason.
And China, though, doesn't China, now you've traveled, but doesn't China still have that one-child policy? Unless I've read, if you might be able to sort of buy your way out of that, but basically, they have tried to keep to the one child since in the 70s, I believe.
Yeah, that was the philosophy behind it, but it has been relaxed because if you're of certain ethnic groups, if you actually live in the countryside, if the first child is a girl, then they're opt out, and if you can, well, you can buy your way out of it. The rich people go to Hong Kong to have their children, mm-hmm. or they go to Singapore or some other country outside China to have their children. So there's a lot of get outs, I think. But it was perhaps a good idea.
I think it was a good idea myself.
Sorry?
I think it was a good idea. At least, you know, they were trying to put a curb on the population.
Yes, they were trying. They were, and a lot of people have been very against that. And I know there have been a lot of bad things in China. Things called the killing rooms, because it's quite a misogynistic culture. So is India in a lot of ways, because
yes.
they have female infanticide, all this kind of thing, which is the bad side of it.
Oh, it's terrible.
But I think certainly if they had a policy of mass sterilization and they could give people incentives, that might be part of the answer. But are people... will then say, oh, it's eugenics, so you have that tag which people will bandy around.
Yeah, it's not a real easy thing. I mean, it sounds simple,
but it's not
that easy to implement or to get people to understand.
No, it's very difficult.
But I wanted to ask, since you've been traveling everywhere, when you go to a country, what do you say, okay, I'm going to go to India? Or do you say, wow, I want to see some wonderful, old, spiritual, holy sites, so I'll go to India? What gets you going to a certain area?
Basically, I just get a one-way ticket. Usually, occasionally I have been on organised trips, actually. If places are very difficult to get visas and it's very bureaucratic, you can't get... I may go on an organised trip. But on the other hand, like when I did my trip around Southeast Asia, that was a period of about a year, 18 months of just travelling around.
Wow.
And you just get a one-way ticket to, say, Bangkok, for example. And then... I have loads of ideas of places I want to go on the itinerary,
mm-hmm.
And most of them I'll go to. But things get very spontaneous when it's like a totally different world.
Right.
Because you'll meet somebody and they say, "Oh, well, let's go here," and you say, "You'll go there," and you'll change your plans. Things will happen. You know, there might be a flood somewhere, or there might be something will happen. You'll have to make other arrangements.
Yeah.
And you might go into a temple and start chatting to a monk, and he might come up with something. You just really don't know. You have. It's like a jigsaw. You have some of the pieces actually fit together fine, and the other pieces, you know, you're searching around. It's not like ordinary everyday living. It almost becomes traveling is a lifestyle of its own,
mm-hmm.
And you just get itchy feet every so often and just to keep moving.
Well, there's a lot of freedom to that without the deadline. Okay, I've got to be at a certain town at a certain date.
No, that doesn't happen.
Yeah. So then when you go back home to Scotland, what gets you on the road again?
I think the monotony of day-to-day existence, really.
Okay.
that's why, although I like gardening while I'm home, a lot of the time in Scotland the weather is so rubbish that gardening isn't the foremost thing on my mind. I'm thinking of sunshine and living in a cold, wet climate. I think that makes me eager to start travelling again.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about actually pulling up stakes from Scotland and... or putting down roots somewhere else?
I don't know. I think wherever I lived, I'd probably be unhappy, but I would be keen to move on somewhere else. But it's good to have a base in Scotland because I can just shut everything down. And as I said, my longest trip was about 18 months. So, and I have had lots of other trips that have taken 6 months, 9 months. I suppose it's good to come back to have somewhere where I have all my books. I've got all my bits and pieces, my music and other things, a small garden, you know, things which I can just come back to and relax. And then when I get bored, and I can, oh, okay, I'll make another trip.
Yeah. Well, now you're actually traveling, like you say, you don't really know, you go someplace and you end up going in this direction with this person or meeting somebody over here. But when you start out, do you say, okay, this trip's going to be for 6 months?
Yeah, there's a minimum period, and I've never normally go less than the minimum period. If I'm going to be away for 6 months, I'll be away for 6 months. It may be longer than 6 months, but unless there's something, a disaster. Actually, there was one incident where I did come back earlier. That's when I broke my ankle in Australia, in the Blue Mountains, and then I had to come home.
Okay.
I actually came home for a few months while my ankle was healing, and then I went out. Then I went off to Burma. So that's actually what happened. So unless I'm forced to come back because I've hurt myself,
right,
or there's been some calamity in a family or whatever, no, I wouldn't normally come back early. No,
earlier than 6 months.
I might leave a particular country at a certain time.
Right.
I might go to another country and say, oh, I won't stay here much longer. I'll go somewhere else.
Yeah.
But no, I wouldn't come back home.
Yeah. Well, what about, like, parents, wife, kids? Do you have siblings?
No children. Divorced. So okay. I've really got no commitments. So really, I'm totally free and easy, really, as a
yeah.
Really, I can just do as I please, basically. Money is the only constraining factor.
Right. Yeah, the money. And actually, you know, being child-free seems, the more I learn about different vegans around the world, the more that seems to be something else that we have in common.
Yeah, because you found me on the Child Free Vegan site, didn't you?
So that it's one of those things, and that's what a friend of mine who isn't, he had just pointed that out recently. He said, well, I think that vegans just don't have kids. I said, well, okay, some might have one, but not... We don't have large families.
I'm not sure. Yeah, probably not more than one or two, probably. No. Because you've got to think about, you know, most vegans, I would think about the impact of having children. And there's no guarantee that child is going to be vegan anyway, and they still make an environmental impact regardless.
Right. Well, sure, they're still going to make an impact. And now there may be some people who have become vegan later after they've had... maybe even several children.
That can happen. That can happen. Yeah. So that is a different scenario, isn't it?
Right. But the people, yeah, that we know, they just don't. And it's not that we hate kids. There's always kids around, you know, to help. The people I know. I mean, he works a lot with like Boys and Girls Clubs of America, with Big Sisters and Big Brothers, and this kind of thing. He does a lot with children, but doesn't have them himself. And so that's why I always told people, well, you know, you can always adopt if you want to raise a child.
That is very much my view, that if you want kids, you can adopt. Because I personally would feel very guilty if I brought a child into the world that was ill in any way, mentally or physically, or was involved in an accident, or, you know, the guilt would just tear me apart,
right.
And as well as the impact on the environment and using resources and all the rest of it that you have to buy for that child. But suffered in any way, you know.
Right, and you know, just the fact that now with all of the toxins in our air and our water on and on, the chances of a child being totally healthy are decreasing.
Yeah.
I mean, so
increases in asthma, for example.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to think about before bringing somebody else into the world. I know that one of the places you traveled in Asia was North Korea.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Do you want to talk to us a little bit?
That's one of my favorite places. That's one of the examples where you have to go on an organized trip. Unless you go into the country illegally, of course.
Wouldn't recommend it. I don't think I'd want to go to North Korea illegally. No.
No, that's not. There was actually a program on yesterday on in BBC Panorama. There's a journalist, John Sweeney, I think his name is, and he went there under the auspices of the LSE, which is London School for Economics, and as if he was part of the organised group, he actually went as an undercover journalist, and you know, he uncovered some quite unsavoury things. But yes, talking about my trip, yeah, you have to get the visa sent, you know, you have to get the visa and all the rest of it done via the actual official Korean travel agency. It's all government sponsored. And you go into tourist hotels. They only take you to the areas they want you to see.
Right.
And so they show you the best of the regime and all the flags and the banners and the propaganda. You cannot avoid seeing some of the poverty. So you are going to see it sooner or later, but they're trying to add to a minimum.
Well, where were you right before you went there? And how long did it take you to get your papers in order to get into North Korea?
It's very easy getting the papers because it's all done for you. You don't really do anything. You have to go through a recognised tour agency in the UK or wherever you are in the world. They all organise. You don't really do anything yourself. It's basically you are there as almost like a guest. And you don't really do anything. You don't organise any of the trips. You don't. Everything, the coach will turn up and take you where they're going to take you for the day. You have no, you're not a free agent at all. So it's all organised. The visa is organised. Everything is done for you. And as I say, every day there's an itinerary which they'll pick you up at the hotel in the tour bus. You go to all the different monuments, the library, the mausoleum or wherever, and they'll show you people that have been vetted, and you'll very rarely get any interaction with ordinary
okay. I wondered about that, if you could actually interact with just the citizens.
No, that's apart from the fact very few speak English. If you go into a restaurant, it'll be all foreigners in the restaurant, and there'll just be a few high-ranking Koreans there.
Cool.
There won't be ordinary Koreans.
Right. So how long were you there for?
I think it was 8 days.
Okay. You saw a lot, though?
One of the most interesting things, we actually got the overnight train from Beijing into Pyongyang, and that is where you did see some ordinary Koreans. There's a lot of Chinese, of course, who go over to work and do things in North Korea, so it's mainly Chinese on the train. But when you actually go across the bridge actually into North Korea, then you actually do see, because you can look out the window, you actually see what life is like there, and you see people working in the fields, you see all the old tractors and people using horse drawn ploughs, that kind of thing, and then you see, you know, you do see the poor people, you know, by the side of the railway, for example.
Yeah, well then, not like you said, okay, you saw that and you saw everything they wanted you to see, but you didn't get to talk to people about their government or anything. What do you think about what's going on right now with the threats from North Korea?
I think as most commentators have said, I think it's basically bluster. This crops up every so often. It's Kim Jong-un, you know, the new leader, who's the grandson of the founder,
mm-hmm.
or son. He basically is making his way in the world. I think he's sort of 29 years old. He's obviously not been in the job very long, and he's got to assert his authority. So I think it's really to influence and to show the general populace that he's in charge, and to try and keep some of the generals in check, to say, well, look, you know, I'm the boss, and if I can get America to either, you know, some people say it's almost like it's a way of getting some more aid out of America or making America compliant in some way.
Yeah.
It's basically real politic. I don't think he actually would launch this strike. I think it's just playing politics.
Right, which everybody does. It seems that all countries do that. So you would think, well, what about, you know, this is supposedly a communist country, although I've never known of any country that actually was communist. You know, people seem to use the word communist as a four-letter word, and they always will mention Stalin, which this was nothing like communism. What kind of a government is North Korea from what you could see, truly?
I think it is probably, some people actually say, it's even more like Hitler than Stalin. In other words, it's very nationalistic. I don't really think, because it's not a country that's invaded other countries to, you know, it's got an empire, you know, mentality. So I don't know where that would compare. But I think, in just the way the goose step in, I suppose, but then a lot of the Russian army used to do the goose step and all the rest of it. But it's the architecture is very based on Stalin and Mao. You know, the big statues of Kim Il-sung, all the revolutionary placards in the streets, the way the people just walk around sort of almost as if they're in a trance. It's very surrealistic. It's like 1984. I don't know if you've read George Orwell's 1984, but it's a very surrealistic sort of...
You didn't see people...
It's an amazing place to see. Sorry.
Well, no, but you talk about them just sort of walking in trance. So you didn't see people being joyous or lively or anything. Sorry for the inconvenience. I don't know what's going on here with Blog Talk. We will air this show again, and it will be on the Facebook page for Aramarte Feo. Thank you. I'm sorry.